Hello, everybody. This is Brian from Necronomicast. Before I bring you my conversation with Lieutenant Joe Kenda, here's a little something for my friends over at the Hollyweird Paranormal Podcast.
Hey guys, it's Tammy Merhep Chavez.
And Bryce Mitchell Williams. We are the hosts of Hollyweird Paranormal. It's a podcast about Hollywood true crime and the paranormal based out of Los Angeles, California.
We spike this Hollywood cocktail with stories of true crime and its paranormal aftermath, along with dirty Hollywood scandals and secrets that make up this weird city of Hollywood and its surrounding areas that make up this crazy state of California.
Catch our episodes every Sunday on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Blueberry, and Stitcher.
Life is too short to be normal. Stay weird with Hollyweird Paranormal.
All right, but you mentioned a cocktail, and now it's all I'm craving.
Right? Let's end this promo and get one.
Yes. Ugh.
In 1988, I was a sergeant in homicide, the supervisor of the homicide unit. I was on TV a lot. The murder guy almost always is.
The individual who lived here was struck in the chest and the ankle by gunfire.
I was good at what I did. There's no question about that. I was. I was getting results. Results are the key. But this case was so different. This is something I had never encountered in all my years. We were dealing with a unique offender. Someone who was born to be what he was. A remarkably dangerous individual.
From Omaha, Nebraska, the capital city of the historic haunted heartland, my name is Brian Corey, and it is my pleasure to welcome you all to this episode of Necronomicast, the finest in creepy conversations. History will be made tonight on the program as I welcome the return of one of the greatest crime fighters in modern American history. That's right, the homicide hunter, Lieutenant Joe Kenda. He returns to the Necronomicast to chat about his new special airing on Investigation Discovery and Discovery Plus, Homicide Hunter, The Man with No Face. It's the story of a heinous crime that shocked a community and the relentless pursuit of justice. Lieutenant Joe Kenda is here for a late night conversation on Necronomicast. And now calling in on the Necronomicast hotline, I've got him. The American detective, the homicide hunter, Lieutenant Joe Kenda. Sir, good evening.
Hello. Good evening to you.
What a great honor to have you on the show, not just once, but again. I told my listeners, I'm like, if I never do another one of these episodes or podcasts again, I'm fine because I talked to Joe Kenda.
That's very kind of you.
Well, I also... I made sure to follow your lead, and I brewed three pots of hot black coffee.
Perfect.
To prepare for this conversation?
Yes. There you go.
It's great because I appreciate this conversation and this opportunity to sit across from you. I'm glad it's me like asking you the questions and not you, you know, like grilling me. Too,
True. Yeah, that's true. I can be unpleasant when it comes to that sort of thing. You know, that's right.
I've heard that. I'm sure there's others in our fine institutions, our correctional facilities across America that would agree with that statement as well. So
that is true. Yes.
Well, we're here to talk about your new special, The Homicide Hunter, The Man with No Face. It premieres on Investigation Discovery on Wednesday, March 8th at 9/8 Central. And it's also going to be streaming on Discovery Plus beginning March 8th. And Joe, I had the opportunity to watch a pre-screening of it. And once again, you and the team, the whole production team, the network, just everybody that was involved with the production, you delivered once again. It's fantastic.
We spent a lot of time. We worked hard on that to present that case. It was it's a terrible case. They all are. They're all terrible. But this particular one, had it not been for the magic of DNA, we would have never, ever found him.
Yeah. As the mystery unravels, it's crazy how that brand new technology in 1988, well, the crime happened in 1988, but how that brand new technology at the time, you know, you started eliminating suspects And then finally, years later, it led you down the road to the killer. So you had a quote during the show that every homicide investigation affects you in some way. And I could tell, especially with this case, how much it affected you, your team, your investigative team, and also the community too, and the family. I felt so bad for the husband of the victim. The victim was Mary Lynn V. Lepondo. She was 24, stabbed, beaten to death, left in an alley, blunt force trauma, but she fought. She fought for her life. They found clumps of hair belonging to the attacker. It was pretty apparent that she fought hard, so the attacker, you know, sustained injuries. She fought like hell.
She did.
And they found her behind that alleyway. Just a terrible story. And you, of course, were lead investigator on that scene.
Yep, it is. They all are. They all have their own horror story to tell. This particular one was especially tough because she's a young girl. She's got her whole life in front of her. She's married. She has a daughter. She's improving herself. She's going to school. She wants to do great things. And someone takes her life, rapes and beats her in the process. And despite her resistance, despite her fighting for her life, she loses the fight. And then, of course, the focus comes upon the family and about the husband and on and on and on. And that's what makes it so difficult. And we were very, very shocked when we discovered who it was that we were actually pursuing. And that's the thing that makes this so compelling and why we selected it to make a 2-hour special out of it, because it's requires 2 hours to tell this story.
Oh, indeed. And her husband, you know, like to kind of set the stage, she went out to a party with her husband, a wedding reception the night before out in Pueblo, Colorado, came home, you know, late at night after a good time, and didn't get into a fight with her husband. But you and I both know that it doesn't take much for us to make our wives irritated with us.
Of course.
So she decides to, you know, blow off some steam, take a walk. And it's one of those stories where just somebody is in the wrong place at just the
precisely the wrong moment. Yeah. Exactly. It was she's a young girl. She's 24 years old. She's emotional. She's very bright. And so when her husband annoyed her, she had an explosive reaction. No physical issue, just really angry. And it was her custom. When she got like that, she knew she had this temper. So she'd go for a walk and settle down and come home and everything would be fine. So he wasn't alarmed when she did that because she did it all the time. But then she didn't come back.
And her parents, they didn't live too far away. And so he was kind of thinking, well, maybe she went over to her parents' house because they were babysitting their young 7-year-old child.
Correct. And he checked the next morning, assuming that's where she was. And they informed him that they hadn't seen her. And then he really became alarmed. And he walked out of his house and began to walk the pathway she usually took. And he saw all the police cars, including me, surrounding a body in an alley a few blocks from his home.
And he recognized
her socks.
Yeah, from the protective police tarp that was covering the crime scene or covering her body from the elements, he recognized the socks poking out.
Yes, he did. So he knew. Right then and there, he knew. And that is the hardest thing anyone can experience. Not just the knowledge of a death, but the discovery of it is extremely unusual.
And you guys are investigating, and lo and behold,
Well, he comes underneath the crime tape or the, mm-hmm. the protective sure. ribbon that you put around the scene to keep people off. And he's, of course, you know, so overcome with emotion. Yep. And he wants to help you guys and see what's going on. And it's his wife. And he knows it, something tragic, terribly has happened. He comes on, you know, he comes to the crime scene. And he approaches you guys and you're like, whoa, 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 whoa.
Yeah, stop. Who are you? And so on. And of course, it's we discover who he is. And one thing leads to another, as they say. And a very unpleasant situation all around for many years until advances in DNA allow us to further process the evidence. The thing that was unusual in 1988, there was no case in the United States. It had been taken to court involving DNA examinations. Brand new science. It was used in England on a couple of occasions. Mm-hmm. Which is where it was invented, but it wasn't used in the U.S. But we got a letter from the state laboratory. That they sent a letter to all law enforcement agencies in the state of Colorado and said, hey, there's some exciting research going on in England regarding identifying uniquely an individual by means of analysis of deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA. We don't know if it's going to work. We don't know many details yet, but we suspect that it could work. So as a result, we're requesting you, agencies, to preserve evidence in the following manner. A list of instructions on what we would have to do to preserve this evidence, body fluid, blood, whatever, for subsequent examination, perhaps decades later. We can still do that. However, the key became, it was expensive and it was complicated. Police departments have to compete for the tax dollar. So they're right away, you say expensive, the management gets nervous. Mm. Well, they don't know if it's going to work and it's going to cost a lot of money. And my argument was, okay, maybe it doesn't work. Maybe it's for nothing. Do you want to tell the families of these people that we're too cheap to investigate their loved one's death? Or can you let me do this? Well, of course, I put it that way. Well, I can't exactly do it. No, you can't. So let's just do it. See what happens. Now, part of the thing, you had to freeze it in liquid nitrogen. I mean, it's complicated. Mm-hmm. The sample, but it was done. And so years and years go by of advances in the science because it's a living, breathing thing. And it advances as it moves forward. So now it's different and better and more unique and more selective and more everything. So now samples that could not be used 30 years earlier can be identified now because of new techniques. So we use those techniques on that same evidence, properly preserved from 1988 to 2021. And they say, it's this guy, to the exclusion of all others on the planet. It's this guy. Just that's a remarkable tool. It is a sea change in law enforcement. And it always has been. And it's always going to be.
That was a very interesting part of the documentary because DNA became part of like the American lexicon, of course, with the O.J. Simpson trial, mm-hmm. you know, starting in 94 and 95. But it's neat to see the evolution of the DNA use in crime. I think in your show, they referred to it, you know, the scientific mumbo jumbo, you know, because it was all brand new technology. Now we take it for granted.
Oh, it was. It was. And what the defense bar has to do is have a defense attorney get a Nobel Prize for proving this is wrong. So far, they haven't done that. So the result is this is a scientific certainty. This is not any other possibility. Of all the humans, 8 billion or so on this planet at the moment, this sample was provided by you and you only. And it's at a crime scene all over the body of a victim. And you're toast at that point.
Yeah. I don't even remember the number that they used. It's like 1 in 27. I don't even know. It sounded like a made up number, like 27 quadrillions or something.
Yeah. You know, was,
of all the people that have ever lived on the history of the planet ever, it's you.
Ever.
It's ever.
You. Yeah. Even if you're 500 years old, that's still you.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's remarkable. And there was a day, I mean, back in the day, in the early, in the late 80s, you needed a microliter of liquid to do a test, which is a lot. Okay. Mm-hmm. Today, touch your desk and I'll tell you who you are. It is remarkable how it's advanced.
Yeah. They made great, a great point of that in the show. They talked about you needed hair from his head and from down there.
Yes.
You needed saliva and you also needed a lot of blood. They took a big, healthy blood sample out of the guy. And now, like
two
you said,
samples.
And now, like you said, they could just, you touch your desk, or I've seen shows where somebody's drinking a water bottle and they set it down in the trash and the detective comes by a little bit later and picks that bottle up out of the trash. And what do you know? We got a sample to test. It's pretty amazing.
And you don't need a warrant to search trash. It's abandoned property. There's no expectation of privacy. So once he disposes of it and leaves the area, it's yours.
There's some great parts of police procedure and on the show too. You guys pulled over a suspect. Actually, he was arrested for DUI that night. Mm-hmm. She was missing an article of clothing. I think it was a jean jacket, and she had been stabbed. And there's a guy, Trenton Hayes, your first suspect on the for this murder. He's out drinking. They arrest him that night for DUI, and lo and behold, you look inside. You, like you say on the show, we can't search his vehicle yet, but we can sure look in the window. And on the seat, well, there's a jean jacket kind of crumpled up. There's a pocket knife, you know, a buck knife sitting there on the seat. And you probably thought, well, hey, we're going to go home early today or something. I don't know what you guys were saying, but.
Well, you'd think at that moment, you say to yourself, boy, there is a God.
Yeah.
Look at this. Yeah, look at this. And then it turns to nothing. It goes up in smoke, as it often does. Homicide investigation is a series of highs and lows, mostly lows, very few highs. Hmm. But when you find a high, it is euphoric.
What I like about your shows is that you show the highs and the lows. You show that you got this suspect, and boy, does he look promising. When she was fighting for her life, she pulled out a big clump of this monster's hair. And it turned out to be like bleach blonde hair. You know, you could tell it was chemically treated.
Mm-hmm.
And the suspect, bleach blonde hair, chemically treated. He looked like he got in a, you know, he's either clumsy or he got in a fight because he's got scratches on him. He's all tore up.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, he gives up all that DNA. Weeks later, the test results come in. That's got to be a punch in the gut. Just.
It is. It always is.
So it's back to the drawing board.
It always is. I had a case once where a guy who owned a liquor store invested in a high-quality video system from Germany. It was 35-millimeter quality. It was amazing. It was as clear as a bell. And he uses it in his store to protect himself from being robbed. Guy comes in, produces a 9-millimeter semi-auto, demands money. And he keeps looking back at the door, the robber does, because he's trying to see if money's going to come in. And this owner times him when he turns his head. When he turned back around to look at the owner broke a bottle of scotch in the guy's face. Now the blood and the scotch goes in the cuts, and the guy is infuriated.
Yeah.
And he stands back up and empties his gun into the owner and then runs. Doesn't even get any money. With this bloody face. We have a suspect, develop one. We can't find him. And so we go to his mother, which I often did. And I brought her into the police station and I said, I want you to watch a movie. It is violent. I will tell you in advance, it's very violent. I want you to tell me if there's anyone in this movie that you recognize. And so we play. She starts to cry. She says, that's my son. Perfect. So she's, where is he? He's in jail. He's where? Well, he's in jail. Well, that should be hard to find. I sent two detectives to the El Paso County Jail to get him out, bring him up here. They come back crestfallen. What's the matter? Well, he's been in jail for 9 months. Uh-oh. So he couldn't be in the store? His own mother fingered him, and it wasn't him. The guy it was looked just like him, but it wasn't her son. This is why I used to go to crime scenes and say, don't tell me you have an eyewitness. And they would say, well, I have an eyewitness. I told you not to tell me that. Eyewitnesses are hopelessly unreliable.
God, you hear the story, like he's got a face, a mug only a mother could love.
Yes. Except she was in love with the wrong face, apparently.
Right. She was in love with fooled her his own mom. Yeah. Yet another quote. It was like, violent crime is a unique thing. If you've ever seen it, you never forget it. It's not like anything portrayed in movies or in television. It's beyond ugly. And I can't imagine, for you guys to investigate these horrible crimes all these years. And then you write about them in your fantastic book. But, that the husband comes and he sees this scene. He doesn't see how graphic it is, but I can only imagine what that poor husband, what Bob went through. And one thing I found very compelling about your show, and I have to hand it to the guys, the production team, everybody involved, they really they interviewed him in a way that really showed what the turmoil and how this guy's life was wrecked by what happened to his beautiful wife. And everything that happened to Bob, he was cleared early on because he didn't have the blonde hair. He had jet black hair, Hispanic fellow. Obviously the DNA, didn't match and it wasn't him, but there was still like a cloud of suspicion over the poor guy that haunted him for years, for decades.
Yes.
Yeah.
Families, friends, coworkers. Well, the police let him go, but you know what really happened here. It's the usual thing. And he suffered for that. He suffered his whole life. I met him when we filmed him. I hadn't seen him since 1988. Mm. And it was very emotional with both he and I. And he put his arms around me. And I did him as well. And I said, I'm sorry, Bob. I was sorry then. And I still am. But we have the guy. Finally.
Yeah, you got this, Joe, you got a reputation, well deserved, of being a hard ass. But I have to tell you that it was really powerful for me, sharing kind of like what you just shared, how you personally viewed, the length of the investigation as your fault, that you couldn't solve it for him sooner, and how awful that you guys felt that he suffered, going through the process of determining if it was he was a suspect, and how he's living under that cloud of suspicion. I mean, the weight of these investigations, day after day, case after case, week, month, years later, it has to weigh on you and your associates so heavy.
It does. There is no question about that. I'm a poster child for PTSD. I've seen death by every means except a nuclear weapon. I've never seen that. But pick any other method, and I've seen many examples. And you cannot unsee what you've seen.
What's harder for you as a detective when you're investigating these crimes? Is it like notifying and working with the family or I don't know, the nuts and bolts, the gruesomeness of the crime scene?
The death notification is the toughest part, in my view. I mean, everybody has a different opinion, but you're standing on somebody's porch at 1 o'clock in the morning wearing a cheap suit and holding up a badge. And somebody's not home who's supposed to be home. And they know it when they look at you. You don't have to say a word. You can see it in their face. They know. Mm-hmm. And the press often says, if there's an arrest made and punishment is offered, prison time is assigned to the individual, that provides closure to the family, and that's nonsense. There's no such thing as closure. The loss of a loved one is a hole in your heart that never heals, ever. That person is never coming home. It doesn't matter what happens to the person responsible. Your loved one is gone forever. And there's no closure from that. None.
When you're working with a whole team, you're really good about sharing the credit on these shows too. We hear from people like Dan May. He was a brand new district attorney, investigator. That was like his first violent crime scene. And
it was.
There's a part in the show where he has to back away from the interview because he was just so overcome with emotion decades later.
Yes.
When he's talking about notifying the relatives, you know, the sisters featured heavily on this show too and everything. Mm-hmm. And you had like Larry Martin, he was a chief of the investigation too, and Brian Ritz. And then, you know, there's like a passing of the baton after your retirement all those years later. And it does a great job of highlighting the work of James Isham and Joe Samosky.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
When I watch true crime shows, and my listeners hear me say this a lot when I have authors on and people in your shoes, I don't care about the perpetrator, you know, hearing that much about him. I mean, some of it might be interesting, you know, maybe it's some of his history and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But what I really enjoy about true crime shows, what I really find interesting is the lives and the tenacity and the determination of the detectives and the investigators and the crime scene technicians and how everybody works in concert. I think you even say something in your book about being a conductor or something in this.
Yeah, you are. You know, it's like organizing. You organize your orchestra when you arrive at a crime scene. And it's a lot of noise. It's really terrible. There's no detectable music there. And you're trying to hear a melody. Mm-hmm. Play me something that has a melody. Tell me something, learn something, point out something that has meaning. I used to tell my detective this all the time. Don't tell me what you think. Don't tell me what you believe. Don't tell me what your gut tells you. Only tell me what you can prove. Because if you can't prove it, it's meaningless. We have to proceed. Somebody did this. Now, who might that be? That's what we're here to find out. And you become a unit, a group, not a person, not me, not somebody. It's all of us. Everyone is just as important as everyone else. We have to do this together. We would have lead meetings every 4 hours in a murder case. Everybody sit around the table. Okay. I'd go around the room. What do you know? What do you know? What do you know? Now everybody knows what everybody else knows. Now, what's left? Well, it's who's the guy in the blue car? Who's the guy that was seen in the window? Who's, you know, and on. You assign tasks. And you say, okay, boys and girls, go out and detect. We're detectives. Go find that out. See you in 4 hours.
Yeah.
And we'll do it again until you have a very cohesive approach. And everyone's up to speed. No one's working in the dark. They all know what is required. They all know what has been learned. Now, what do we learn next that's going to be important? That's the game.
Now, I have a musical background. I studied music in college, and I'm a trained trumpet player. And when you have this analogy of being the master conductor of this investigative orchestra or ensemble, mm-hmm. trumpet players musically are sometimes known as kind of being the a-hole of the of the ensemble. Did you ever have like detectives that you're like, I don't know if you're cut out. I don't know if you're cut out for this, either your attitude or for homicide, because that's a special breed of police officer, homicide.
It is. And occasionally you find someone who thinks they want to do this, but they really kind of don't. Mm. And you have to take them aside and say, you know, you look unhappy. You look uncomfortable. You seem nervous. What's up with that? What isn't what you thought it would be? Well, no, it's not. Well, then maybe we should try something else. Go be a motorcycle officer or go back to patrol or whatever, because I don't think this is for you. It requires a certain individual who's willing to put everything aside in pursuit of who did this. If someone does something unspeakable to someone else, you have two options. You can remain seated or you can stand up. Hmm. I always stood up. I'm proud of that. But so did all my people. And we did it together. It's a team. A team that's a well-oiled machine. After a few drinks, you can convince yourself you work for the Lord himself.
Amen.
Hey, you're not just the police, you're the murder police, for yeah. God's sake. You know, yeah, of course, that's the game. And you suffer together, too. I mean, when things aren't working and things aren't happening and we can't turn a lick on who this might be, and everybody is staring at the floor, right? Mm-hmm. You have to be the cheerleader and you have to say, hey, we don't know much, but the more we work at it, the more we're going to learn. So let's get back to it. Let's start over if we have to. What did we miss? What did we not see? What did we ignore that turns out to be important? And that is the difference. Being willing to say, we did something wrong. We made a mistake. We missed something. We didn't ask the right question of the right person. So let's go back and talk about it. Who did what first? Who did what next? And then see if there's an avenue that we just didn't quite pursue. And you often find one. So what about that? You know, oh, yeah, we could do that. Hmm. And you'd be amazed how that works sometimes. So it's all a process of being willing to take what's there and work it as long and as hard as you can. I worked one case for 9 years. Drove me crazy. But I finally convicted two people of first-degree murder. 9 years later, and it was the first DNA case that actually went to court in 1991 in Colorado. First one in Colorado.
I know exactly which one you're talking about. And this is a great this is a great segue, because I wanted to talk about your book. I know you got more than one, but the one that I've read, couldn't put it down, read it like on a Friday night through a Saturday, and then, you know, cashed it on Sunday. Joe Kenda, Killer Triggers. And I know you're talking about, you got to be talking about the Eric Houston case.
I am. Eric Stanley Houston. Nobody cared about Eric except us.
Joe, that's exactly what I wanted to, that's why I wanted to bring it up with you, because so many times, you know, nowadays in this climate and of defund the police and they're all this BS. In that book, in that chapter, I got to hand it to you. The case of Eric Houston, and just real quick for my listeners, it's a case of a young man. He was he suffered a head injury when he was younger, just kind of a simple guy, worked at Goodwill, sweeping floors and mopping floors. He liked to drink. You know, he just, you know, he had his vices, but, you know, just by all accounts, just a, you know, just a kind of a simple man, had his problems.
Mentally, he was 8 years old.
Yeah.
And his major difficulty is he was unable to assess people for what they were. If you were nice to him, then you must be his friend. Mm-hmm. They would drink his whiskey, spend his money, and blame him for every crime they committed. Eric got arrested a lot, never convicted of anything because he never did anything. Mm-hmm. But he was everybody's go-to suspect if they committed a crime. That lay it out for somebody. That say, oh, it was him. He did it. And Eric never did anything. He was an oops baby. Parents were older. And when they died, he finally got swept up in some community program. He was a black kid. He was not bright. He was all those things. The press ignored the murder. It was in the wanted. Man found in motel. You know, that's about what it said. Mm-hmm. And we worked that case as hard as any other. And I had a new detective once. First day of the job, he comes in. I said, take this lead and work the, it's the Eric Houston case. Go find this out for me. Well, that's that guy in the motel on the west side. I said, it is. Well, nobody cares about him. And everybody in my unit just all found something else to do because they knew what was coming. And I turned white as a piece of paper. And I turned to that kid. I said, don't you ever say that to me in your life. Because if you say it again, I'm going to have you at the airport writing tickets from midnight to 8 with Tuesdays and Thursdays off. Now, do you read me? Yes, sir. Now, you go work that lead and you come back and tell me what you've learned. And he got a lesson from that. He never said that again, and he was a good kid. But initially, he was like everybody else. Nobody cares about Eric. Oh, yes, we do. And we finally turned it, finally, mm-hmm. through DNA.
And like you said, it was the first case in Colorado where there was a mm-hmm. conviction with DNA. Now, your other case that we correct. Were talking about from the show, that was the first one where you guys actually submitted DNA. But the first one mm-hmm. solved was this one with Eric Houston. And I loved that part of the book because he was found in this seedy kind of flop house.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
No-tell, motel.
You wouldn't keep a dog you didn't like in that motel. You wouldn't. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's in fact, to this day, it still exists. And on their website page, they have a cockroach of the name of the place. That's a clue, as they say in the police business.
Yeah. Yeah. Incredible story. And I can imagine the look on that detective's face when he said that to you. It was must have been like Mount Saint, Kenda, you know, just
I've had a temper. I mean, I try to control it and I have controlled it over the years, but mm-hmm. I do have a temper and he pushed my button and then I pushed all of his, he got the message.
I'm sure he did. And with that book, it's not a criticism of your shows because I love Homicide Hunter. My wife and I had like a marathon. We watched like two or three in a row and just like, they just go right into each other. It's just like, let's watch another. All right. It's like the streaming, you know, it just throws another one right to you, you know.
Well, there's 144 of them, so there's plenty to watch.
I haven't watched all of them, but by the time we talk again, I'll watch all of them for sure.
That's crazy.
What I love about your book though, it really helps like the layman like me understand better or get a little bit clearer picture of the lawman that you are. Because it's really hard to relate to, you know, we watch a show and 42 minutes later, you got your man. You know, a half hour later, you got your guy. You know, 15 minutes in, you're interviewing your first suspect. But the book does a great job of showing the hundreds and thousands of man hours that go into finding a suspect and then another suspect. And then like with the case of Eric Houston, I think you guys had like 52 suspects because people coming and going to that shithole motel all the time.
Yes. And they all have a criminal record as long as your arm. And they all knew Eric because they stopped by for a free drink. Mm-hmm. So all these people are capable of murder. And the people that killed him stole a $40 radio. That was their purpose.
Yeah.
$40.
And he was just a gentle
soul. $40 retail. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they stabbed him 31 times and left him like a dead dog sitting up against his bed. A horrible thing. And no one is there to mourn him. Family was all gone. You know, there's just Eric and us. The press didn't stay there 5 minutes. They made a judgment. Mm-hmm. This person isn't worthy. Oh, really? Oh, really? No one is empowered to take a human life. No one gets to play God. You kill one of my taxpayers, I take it personally.
That's right. When I'm sitting watching Homicide Hunter, I pull out my phone sometimes and I Google the perpetrator that you catch. Or, you know, I kind of like, oh, let me look at some Colorado news stories about what I'm watching here. And sometimes the person that you've spent this part of your career chasing, finding out who they are, all your work, they get convicted. And then on the judicial side of things, well, they might get plea bargained or they might have good behavior in jail. They get time off. They get let go. As a lawman, and you see that, and you spend all this time putting this SOB behind bars, and you know, I guess it's legal, but you know, it is,
and it's very frustrating, and it's the nature of the system that, you know, incarcerating people is expensive. Mm-hmm. So the politicians of the world immediately look for a way to avoid some of that expense. For example, a penitentiary year is not a calendar year. A penitentiary year is 7 months long. They reduce everything to avoid the expense of feeding him and watching him and providing him with a lockup facility. So there's always, they're looking for one method after another to release people because they don't want to pay for it. Well, it is. It's always been that way. I have a more draconian approach that probably would get me a lot of bad press as to what we should do with these people. But nonetheless, you know, that's not my job.
Right.
I can bring a guy into court because this is my job. And I can say to a jury, you see that guy sitting there in the chair, dressed in a suit with a fresh haircut? Let me tell you what he did. Show the crime scene, show the victim, show that. Now, let me tell you how I know that. Then you explain the process, how which you determined it was him and no other. And say, now, what do you think you ought to do? Should we take him out in the alley and shoot him in the head? Or should we give him a silver star? Now, while you're considering that options, don't go anywhere. Because I'm going to be right back with another one. And we'll get to do this all over again. And that's the way it is. What the judicial system does with them once I present them, I have no control over. Here he is. Here's what he did. Here's what he was convicted of. You said life without parole. The question becomes, did you mean that? Because in many ways, you do not. In Colorado, before they had without parole, if you were sentenced for first-degree murder, 25 years into your sentence, you can have a parole hearing. And sometimes 20, sometimes 18 years, depending upon your behavior in prison, so on and so on. So this, a woman that I arrested for first-degree murder, gets an advocacy group from Australia, for heaven's sake. I mean, who knows why, but she did. All women saying that this poor girl was under the Svenvali-like influence of her boyfriend when she committed this crime, and she should be forgiven and released and this and that and the other. So I go to the parole hearing. So I went to the hearing. And she's sitting there in the chair, and she gives me this death look when I walk in. I said, hello. Prison hasn't been kind, has it, my dear? You look awful. Oh, so I walked over, I sat down, and the parole board's like 12 people, and I always sit around it. And everybody said, oh, she's so nice. And she writes religious songs. And oh, isn't that nice? You know. So finally they asked, is there anyone here would like to make a statement? I said, I would. And who are you? I'm the arresting officer. Oh, well, go ahead and take the podium. And I said, take the podium. I said, I have a question. I just have one question. I don't know who to direct it to. It's my understanding we're here to determine if this inmate should be get an early release from prison. Is that correct? Well, of course. It's a parole hearing. Okay. My question is, which one of you can arrange for the victim to get an early release from her grave? Would that be you? Or maybe it's you. or you met him. Perhaps you're the one that can do that. And they just look at me. You're a pin drop in there. The next statement is parole is denied. Now, after you do the first time hearing, have another one in 5 years. So I walked by the table as I was leaving and I said, hey, I'll see you in 5 years. But didn't happen. She died of cancer.
Oh, yeah.
Higher court became involved, you know, and she went away. Fine. But yeah, it's like you have to follow these things because it's a part of your life. You can't control it, but you might be able to influence it. For example, a parole hearing. Not very often. Usually they make a decision with no public invited. But sometimes you can go. Can always go, but sometimes they do say, well, if there's anyone that has something to say, that'd be me. But whatever.
You retired in 96. When was the last time you've been to a, have you been to a parole hearing lately or last couple of years or?
Yeah, I have. And I've also testified in court lately too, which is like weird. Right? Yeah. In 2021, the thing was funny. Just 2 years ago, one of my DNA cases that got resolved, my old unsolved. But the notoriety I have today is rather extensive. So when I walked in that courtroom, you could hear a pin drop. Even the judge is staring at me because it's like, there's that guy, you know, the guy that's on TV. That's him. It was amazing. You know, it was like, oh my God, you know, it's that guy. Because it was my case from 1984, you know, that we're there to put this guy in prison for. And when he killed that girl, he was 24 years old and he's sitting in that courtroom, he's 58. Looking rather bewildered, you know. I walk by him. I say, "Michael, it's time to go to jail."
Yeah.
And they put him away for life without, you know, in 3 hours. DNA.
You walk into that courtroom and they're like, "There's that guy that's on TV." And yeah, I'm on TV now, but for decades, I was the detective pounding the pavement, knocking on doors. You know, collecting the DNA or seeing the bodies and you know, interviewing the
attending
witnesses.
Autopsies and, you know, all the fun things. Sure, girl.
One thing I just don't see like how you switch gears, like talking, you know, 1 minute you're talking to, you know, a family and trying to gently get information about the victim. Like, you know, who were their associates? What were their, you know, where did they work? What did they do? And you're getting information as gently as you can, but you got to get the information.
Oh yeah.
And then you turn around and then you got somebody sitting in some squirrely guy sitting in a chair across from you. And you're really putting the fear of the Lord into him, hopefully, to get information out of him. I mean, those are much different interrogation techniques.
There are a number of things. I think what you should do if you interrogate for the new detectives of the world, find a style that you're comfortable with. Mm-hmm. Don't try to copy somebody else. Find something that fits your personality, that you feel good about, and try it out. Trial and error. How does it work? Does it work pretty well? Or doesn't it work at all? Then we got to change our method. But if you just work with something that you think you're comfortable with, it works. And if you can do so without raising your voice, without using profanity, without doing anything but pointing out the gaping holes in this guy's story, which was my technique, it can be very effective. I had a guy tell me that he did a certain thing. He dropped his girlfriend off at the club because she wanted to go dancing and he wanted to go to work. She was miffed. He watched her walk in the door. Then he drove home. He stopped at a 7-Eleven to buy a pack of cigarettes, and then he went to his apartment. And how long did that take you? And he was very, very serious. He said, it took me about 20 minutes. I remember looking at my watch when I left the club, when I saw her walk inside, the last time I ever saw her. And then I looked at the clock when I got home and I thought I had to go to bed so I could go to work the next day. Now, this girl's body wasn't found for 4 months.
Ooh.
So we had no physical evidence of use because of decomposition. So I said, you know, that's interesting. You tell me this story. And I said, are you sure? Yeah, you didn't leave anything out. No. So that's what you did. You went to these places and it took you about 20 minutes. Is that right? Yes. Well, according to your landlord, you got home at a certain time, which was an hour and 15 minutes after you dropped this girl off at the club. So I thought, well, he made a mistake. So I sent a couple of my detectives the same night of the week, the same time of the evening, to sit in front of that club, simulate watching someone walk inside. They drove to a 7-Eleven. They stood in line. They bought a pack of cigarettes. Then they drove to your apartment. They did that 10 times. You know how long it took them each time? It took them 17 minutes. But somehow, it took you an hour and 15 minutes. Then you get real close to him, real close to his face. You say, you know, that's odd, isn't it? Don't you find that to be odd? I just look at him.
Beads of sweat coming down.
That was enough. I mean, he said, I didn't mean it. He punched her and knocked her over a cliff, which killed her, okay, in a fight. I didn't mean it. Well, I know he didn't probably mean it. But see, the problem is she's dead. Because of you. So they use those techniques that work. I never yelled at him. I never yelled at anybody. You just talk to them. And you let them understand that you know what they did. And you're going to prove it to a jury of 12 people. That's all you have to do. Now, it's very rare to get a confession. You get something. You get statements. You get maybe a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but you never get the truth. You get some of it. But you rarely get a confession like that guy when he said, I admit it. That's rare. The common thing is, I want a lawyer. I don't know what you're talking about. That's what normally happens. And if they say to me, well, I want a lawyer. I said, well, that's probably sensible because in your particular case, my boy, you probably need two lawyers. This conversation's over. You know what I mean? Yikes. And you let him think about that. Let him think about it. You know, because he will.
Yeah.
The human mind, or you say to someone, how many mistakes do you think you made? Did you make 5 mistakes? Could you have made 10? Could you have made some you don't remember making? I've got nothing else to do but find those. And just watch him. And his eyes go to pinpoints. Because his wheels start turning. And that's what you want. You want him worried that his story isn't working. So then he'll change the story. Now you're lying. If you're going to tell me a lie, I'm talking to the right guy. Innocent people don't lie. So are you lying 2 hours ago when you said this? Are you lying now? Did you say this? Or maybe you're just a liar. What do you think? And watch him again for a reaction. You'll get one. Humans are predictable. By the way, speaking of books, I have a new one coming out.
Yes.
My first novel.
A novel?
July 25th. A novel. July 25th. Based on my experience and cases. All right. But I'm very proud of it. And I think it's quite good. And it's titled, the title is All Is Not Forgiven.
All Is Not Forgiven.
It's coming out in July. Yeah, July 25th. You can pre-order it on Amazon right now. It's on there already.
Nice.
I haven't recorded the audiobook yet, but I will.
Are you going to do it yourself?
Mm-hmm. I always do them.
Fantastic. So that goes along with I Will Find You, and then this classic tome here, Killer Triggers. Love that.
Yep. And now this one, All Is Not Forgiven.
All Is Not Forgiven. Coming out this summer.
Yep.
I mentioned that I watched your show with my lovely wife. We were binging the show and watching a bunch of it. And we thoroughly enjoy watching it together. She had a question for you though.
Sure.
You know, as you know, just thinking as a wife, after all this stress and turmoil and, you know, the pursuit of justice all these years. And now she's wondering like, what do you do now? Like, you must have like all this pent up, you know, you're so busy for all these years and always on the go and thinking and working. What do you do to unwind and how do you spend time now?
Well, I like to travel and my wife enjoys traveling. We met in high school. We've been married for 55 years.
Congratulations.
She hasn't killed me, although she's thought about it several times, sometimes quite seriously, I'm afraid, but you know, she's never done it. So that's a good thing. And we travel, we go see our kids and, you know, our one child lives, not child, he's a man, but he lives in close to us here. And the other one, our daughter, lives 1,000 miles away. So we go visit and we go see everybody and so on. But I stay busy because I've been busy all my life. I'm not going to stop being busy.
Right.
If you sit down, you die. I don't sit down. I'm writing a fourth book right now. But the third book comes out pretty in July, and then there's another one coming. So another novel. So it's done pretty well, and TV does well. So and we're starting a new season of American Detective. It's been renamed a Homicide Hunter: American Detective. Was the new name of the one we're starting to film here March 6th. And another series as well. I don't know much about it. They haven't determined what it is yet, but they're going to have a second series with me also at the same time. So on the ID channel. So things are moving along. Keeps me out of the bars.
You know? Keeps me out of the bars. Right on. Well, good. She was wondering because we were just talking about like, you know, it's just, you know, it's case after case. And the way you describe some of these victims that you find, one of them, I stopped reading and I was like, you were describing like somebody was beat up with a bat so bad that they looked like, God, how did you put it? Like just something in a duffel bag. I was like, I can't.
Bones in a duffel bag. Yeah. Oh yeah.
In my own mind, I'm like, that sounds, it looks disgusting. And you're actually,
I once discovered a body that it was the victim of an explosion.
Oh God.
And there wasn't much body, you know, but the feet were there. And one of my detectives said, what do you think, men or women? I said, well, those are men's work boots. I think it's a man. And it was.
Last time you were on my show, you talked about how you guys found a head in the crisper of a refrigerator.
True. Yes. Oh, well, maybe he was going to make a salad. Right. I mean, who knows? You know, but yeah, you get past all that fairly quickly.
Yeah.
Because you have to. It's self-defense. You develop this gallows sense of humor because it's that or cry all the time.
Right.
Crying gets very old.
Right. Yeah. Well, Joe, as our time comes to a close here, I just got to thank you once again. I really enjoy doing like, you know, this show and talking to people, but to have the opportunity, not once, but twice in the history of the show to talk to Joe Kenda. And I'm really looking forward to reading a novel by Joe Kenda. And then you're writing another one. I'm like, you know, God bless you, man. Like, keep it up. Like, don't stop.
I'm not going to. I've worked all my life, and I'm not going to stop doing that. I see no point in it. I see no point in it. Yeah. That's my clock. Sorry.
That's right.
We got that as a wedding gift. It's a heck of a clock. It's 55 years old. It still works.
And they don't make them like that anymore.
No, they don't. In fact, a clock guy was into clocks. They said, where'd you get that? And I said, 1967. What? I said, well, I did. Still there. Still works. Keeps good time too.
All right. Well, Joe Kenda, the Homicide Hunter, the Man with No Face premieres on ID Investigation Discovery on Wednesday, March 8th at 9:08 Central. The special is also streaming on Discovery Plus beginning March 8th. So Joe, man, my best to you, my best to Kathy, my best to your kids and your whole team there at Discovery, at Investigation, the whole crew. You guys are doing great things, and it's such an honor and a pleasure to talk to you once again. I wish nothing but the best for you and everybody else that you know is in your life.
Thanks for having me on your show, and thanks for the kind words.
You bet, Joe. Thanks again.
There he is, everybody. The Homicide Hunter making a return appearance on Necronomicast for episode 244. The great Joe Kenda. Looking forward to his books. Looking forward to the rest of his television career. A great guy. I'm so lucky to have him on the show. Not once, but twice. Maybe a third time. You never know. Coming up on 245 of the Necronomicast, Eric Mahoney. Eric put together an incredible documentary about the band Brainiac entitled Transmissions from Zero. What happened to Brainiac in the 90s was a tragedy, but in honesty, it's not a tragic story. It's a fantastic story, one that I'm so excited to bring to you. Me and Eric on the next episode. One of my new obsessions is the Hollyweird Paranormal Podcast out of Hollywood, California, and I want to thank Tammy for buying me a cup of coffee. Thank you, my friend. Thank you for supporting my show. My best to you guys out there on the best coast. If you'd like to help out the Necronomicast putting together this this endeavor, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/Necronomicast. Help me help the creatives that I feature on my show. Subscribe, like, follow. Thanks so much. Have a great night. Great life. Now go get some sleep.